From San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
Think of the federal government, if it had this kind of access, what we could do in terms of delivering public information to people. The possibilities are enormous. But we do see through a glass darkly, no question about it. And I think our job, therefore, is to try not so much to predict the future, but to enable it to unfold, to create the policies that will provide a clear, attractive environment for us to explore this thing, try it out, see what you can do with this kind of information system, and then make some investments, especially in the public sector, to use this to make their jobs work better for their clients.
Dr. John Gibbons is basically our chief scientist. He's the assistant to President Clinton for Science and Technology. He's the director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, chairman of the Federal Coordinating Council for Science, Engineering, and Technology, and executive director of the National Space Council.
Dr. Gibbons, as science advisor to the president and director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, just what is it you do?
One of my first jobs, of course, is to try to be a resource for the president and in this administration also the vice president on matters that relate to science and technology, whether it be in defense or agriculture or basic science. So I have to be an access for them to any one or another of science and technology issues. And in carrying out that function, I've been drawn into a lot of the big science issues, such as space station and the superconducting supercollider and a lot of these big projects, and also drawn into helping organize a way that the White House can pull together all of these different federal agencies into a much more coherent package of things, including the defense conversion business, the question of trying to get our civilian sector technology up to speed, trying to help create better opportunities for small businesses to get started, because that's where the jobs come from. So it's a great panoply of things, mostly being a kind of a catalyst working out of the White House to make the executive branch look much more like a cohesive whole instead of a bunch of separate activities.
Now, how does science and technology policy get communicated from the president's office to all the agencies which perform all this science and technology research?
Well, in large measure through the cabinet itself, the president's cabinet. When we prepared the initiatives that were announced at San Jose back in February, mm-hmm. this was done under our leadership of OSTP, or the Office of Science and Technology Policy. But each of the agencies gave us support and assistance in drawing this thing together. So it was our job, along with them, to make a single coherent package out of all these different agencies. And so we work with the cabinet secretaries as well as the administrators of the agencies and through an activity that is called FixIt. FixIt stands for, you know, if it's a federal activity, it's got to have some doggone name attached to it. But FixIt stands for Federal Coordinating Committee on Science, Engineering, and Technology, FCCSET. And we do try to fix things. And those FixIt groups are chaired by me, usually, mm-hmm. And then they have subcommittees, but they are the place where each agency sends a senior-level representative, and they work together on these issues, and OMB and other people that control budgets sit in, and it's a kind of an internal self-discipline within the executive branch to pull together on things instead of have all these separate entities.
There were some initiatives proposed in April of this year that FixIt did. Can you quickly tell us what those were?
Well, I'll give you a few of them. One is, as you know, that our nation has sort of spurted ahead from time to time on the back of some new great adventure. One great adventure in the last century was the railroad that linked east and west and provided for making a country out of a very large distance. Then came our national highway system right after World War II, another kind of an infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And telephone and radio and other things have tied us together as a people in a way that is essential, I think, in a modern society. Well, the newest highway that we're trying to build is called a national information highway or infrastructure. And that's a great deal of interest to the administration because things are happening so fast there, you know, from your own background, that we can do things 1,000 times faster or 1,000 times more information per second or 100 times cheaper with this business of information movement. And we all have some notion of this with cable television, with modems and faxes and everything else. Well, the question is that how can we take advantage of this technology, which is continuing to unfold at an extraordinary rate, unbelievable rate of speed? How can you use this thing in ways of improving competitiveness in business, improving education or the delivery of health care services, or linking libraries together in this whole new mode of information access? And that's one of several so-called fix-it groups that are pulling together the resources of NASA and Commerce and NSF and the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense, all working together to try to help create this process. We're doing it in two ways. One is we're trying to change the regulatory and other kinds of public policies so that the private sector will have a much more attractive situation in which to invest and build this national information system. The other thing we're trying to do is to experiment with end users, teachers in classrooms, doctors in remote hospitals and the likes, so that they can understand how they can take advantage of this thing that's coming down the road so fast. So that's one area. Another area has to do with global climate change, working across the different agencies of responsibility. Another has to do with developing advanced manufacturing methods so we can beat the Japanese at their own game of flexible manufacturing and maybe help Detroit build a new car that gets rid of pollution problems and other things. So there are about a half a dozen of these. Another very important one has to do with math and science education, school-to-work transitions, adult training, using the finest of our modern technologies to help this process so we can compete. You know, we've been losing our clocks have been cleaned by the Japanese and others lately in terms of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Our good jobs seem to be moving overseas. It's time for that to stop. And that to stop it means a public-private partnership. Instead of fighting each other, the government and the private sector ought to be working with each other in those areas where we both have things to contribute. And that's the mood we're trying to cast with these committees.
How did the Fix-It initiatives relate to the technology initiative?
Well, the Fix-It initiatives are the mechanism by which the technology initiatives can be carried out. The technology initiatives are the policy decisions of the president, but here's how we want to go. Fix it is how to make it work, how to make it actually work and engage these agencies in a way that they cooperate with each other instead of running off like independent groups. You know, someone once described, I think it was Harvard University, as being a place where you have independent fiefdoms loosely connected with a common heating plant. Well, sometimes the executive branch of government seems to look that way. You got Commerce over here and Energy over there and NASA over here, all sort of independently operating. Well, that's very inefficient. And what we're trying to do is provide the glue to pull these folks together so that they not only know each other, but they're working with each other, and they are trading off in terms of their budgets and resources so that the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts. Al Gore calls it a gestalt for the executive branch, and we're serious about it, because we think we can get a lot more out of the same loaf. The loaf is not going to grow. We're assuming we won't have more resources. We just have to use those resources available to us more efficiently.
You know, when you were speaking earlier about education and technology education, science, engineering, technology education, I think a lot of people say, oh, that doesn't apply to me. You know, the whole concept, I know when I was growing up, the concept was your grandfather learned a trade at 17, and that's what he did for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. And in a scientific, technological society, whatever you learn, what I learned at 17, which is when I first got into computers, I was in computers before it was fashionable. I'm telling you, I grabbed computers. That isn't the greatest thing ever. I was a real dinosaur. But what I learned at 17 literally was obsolete by the time I was 19. And I kind of went, what do you mean I have to learn a new language?
That's right.
What do you mean I have to do that? So the whole mindset of workers in our economy, in our society, says you must always be prepared to learn. So in the technology initiative, the fix-it initiatives, what I'm seeing is a real commitment, yes, certainly to the kids in school, there's no doubt about that, but also to ongoing retraining, refocus, just keep learning about what's going on.
That's exactly right. In the old days, you could think of yourself as being the learning by the time you're 17 how to farm, and then you farmed the rest of your life. You'd improve as you go along with experience, but basically that was your life activity. Nowadays, in our society, in any advanced industrial society, we live more by our wits than by the strength of our backs. And our wits have to change as well, because technology drives a system that is best characterized by constant change. And I think in the computer business especially, about every 3 years you have a new generation of computers. People have to grow along with the technology or it's going to leave them in the dust, and we can ill afford to be left in the dust. So our feeling is that we have to better prepare everyone to be able to live, compete, and contribute in a highly technological world. Like it or not, that's the future that basically we've chosen for ourselves. Now, that means you need to be able to add, okay, and subtract, and a lot of people can't do that. And that means they're left behind in the dust, even to be a part of a democratic process. In other words, the notion of literacy now goes far beyond what we ever thought about literacy back in the old days. And that means math and science education, simply to be an adult able to understand what's going on around you and to be your own governor in the democratic world. Then if you also want to have a chance at a good job, you have to have that background, and it has to be constantly fed. We used to think of workers as things that you, as people you employ, and you sort of use them over time and then they retire, okay? That's no longer how you have to think about people. People are assets that constantly require and are justified in being further in, a subject of further investment. We can invest in ourselves every year, all the time, so that our workers, you and I and the rest of us, are constantly upskilled, because that's where the jobs are going. They're going up, and if we don't go up with them, we're out there in the cold.
And it's a little tough, I think, for small businesses, which are always kind of making it, you know, you're making the decision on a day to day, what do we spend money on, what don't we, for them to understand in a technology sense that if you don't keep investing in your people, well, you might have a product right now, you're not going to have one 2 years from now.
That's exactly right. And it seems to us that this is, again, another classic case of partnership. The people, through government, have a self-interest in acquiring and maintaining the kind of knowledge that gives you power and gives you economic opportunity. The private sector needs highly skilled people in order to compete in their world. So here is a natural partnership, public-private, not only in the formal years of education, but in getting kids out of school and into the workplace, which is another transition, and then also this business of training, adult training. So what we're trying to do in these initiatives is to provide a source of help and assistance in training and education, in technology extension or assistance, especially to small business, so they have better access to the same sorts of front-edge technologies that the big guys have.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. John Gibbons, Assistant to the President for Science and Technology and Director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. In line with bringing everyone into the fold, the private sector with the government and driving science and technology forward, there is a model in the technology initiative of Semitech.
Yes.
And further consortiums. Tell us about Semitech and your hope for these consortiums.
Well, I think Semitech is a good example of a joint venture, public and private funds flowing into it, to develop what one might call generic technologies, pre-competitive technologies, that enable then this nation, for a given set of resources or investments, to compete much more directly with other countries around the world. It's truly a kind of a consortium of public and private contributions, and there are others like it. For instance, there is an advanced battery consortium now to try to develop the technology that will enable us to store electricity so California can have, for instance, clean cars down in the L.A. Basin instead of choking to death on the emissions from internal combustion engines. We feel that there are many opportunities where the public need and the public good can be very well aligned with the private needs and private opportunities, and therefore have a powerful consortium of interest. Semitech is a good example of that. They have moved ahead in certain areas of solid-state physics and applied microelectronics that have enabled us to be much more competitive and, in fact, turn around a losing situation into a gaining situation in areas of integrated circuitry. Well, there are a number of other areas where this can happen. What we feel is that this is a good example of the nation solving problems and capturing opportunities by public-private cooperation, rather than this kind of adversarial relationship that has dominated the scene for the last decade or so.
I think this is very important, and I'd like to ask you to go a little further, and that our idea of companies in a particular area is that they're extremely competitive with each other, and the first one out there, you know, gets the honeymoon period.
Sure.
And you don't really even want to talk about what you're working on. How
That's right.
do you get everybody talking and contributing, and then they have to kind of go back into a competitive mode?
That's a
how
good
does
question.
That work?
Good question. And it seems confusing, but if you talk to folks in the industry, I've been talking, for instance, quite a bit with Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors people lately, because they have a lot of problems that in part are our problems as well. For instance, emissions, cutting down emissions from automobiles. And they know just about exactly where the line is between things they can cooperate on and everybody gain, such as the fundamental chemistry and physics of nitrogen, NOx, nitrogen catalysis, so you can scrub nitrogen emissions from internal combustion engines. They know just how far they want to go together on that and where they'll split out in terms of what they're going to do to their own cars. And they see very natural this dividing line between so-called pre-competitive and competitive or product-related things. So when you sit down with the industry and talk about it with them, they find it much less difficult to define that line than you might think. And I've been very encouraged by running into this. And therefore, I feel much more at ease about how we can match up with them. All we have to do, that is the government side, is to figure out what is our interest, where is the public interest clearly enough evident that we're willing to put public funds into a process, and where is it that it becomes a private interest dominated, and therefore we cut loose and not get involved.
So it looks like from the government side, it's like we're going to point to several areas, there are a number of areas, saying, hey, let's make progress over here.
Right.
And the private concerns come together, and then they naturally know when to come apart.
They know when they want to stop talking with each other and go back to their own back rooms and go to work. So I think this is the way I hope things are going to move. We've been adjusting the notion of antitrust for a long time. We want to make sure the marketplace stays competitive, because that's a magical force that you have to preserve. But there are a lot of things happening in the market that are driven not so much by the traditional private market forces, but by public policy. Take the automobile. Air emissions from automobiles are not so much a market factor as they are a public policy factor. So if we can help Detroit, for example, make a better catalyst so that they can control emissions from those machines better, that's going to enable them to compete in the global marketplace better, and to enable it'll enable them to deliver the goods to us better, and it'll enable us to have the public goal of a cleaner air. So there's a match of public and private interest, and you can find this across in many areas.
Throughout the technology initiative, I was fascinated by all the different ways that were foreseen for these information superhighways. You know, you were mentioning it earlier, you know, information going into schools, universities, people interacting in their homes, in their workplaces. Just the concept of so much more available. We're going to use it in different ways that we really don't know how yet. We're doing a number of experiments saying, okay, try this, and we'll know what works and what doesn't work and that type of thing. And while I get the concept, I'm a little unclear on our specific goal. Now, I understand, and this is just from a numbers standpoint, I understand we're going to build a road from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And I understand we're going to the moon. When I see a data network, like an information superhighway, I ask, how much data needs to move from where to where, how fast?
Excellent question. Just last week, we held the first meeting of our interagency task force on this information infrastructure. And I talked with them about the fact that one can understand the technology pretty well, and one can understand this extraordinary capability that's now in front of us. It's mind-boggling to think of a factor of 1,000 or 10,000 over where we are now. And so you really can't quite see yet what's going to happen. You really do have this overwhelming conviction that any time you can do something 1,000 times better, there are going to be some very interesting applications and possibilities. But it is a dimly seen event. There's a biblical term that goes something like, we see through a glass darkly, and then we see face to face. And in a sense, what we see here is through a glass darkly. We know that there's some very interesting opportunities there. But then if we can see each other more face to face, that is, use this network as a much better way of drawing ourselves together. So you can have virtual classrooms with kids from St. Louis to New Orleans, involved in the same class, say, in Japanese for fifth graders, cheaply enough that you can afford a Japanese teacher and create that virtual classroom. That's working today.
Yeah.
That's but one example, I think, of the opportunities that lie in the public sector for the more efficient delivery of goods and services. Think of the federal government, if it had this kind of access, what we could do in terms of delivering public information to people, delivering checks or welfare information or hospital records or other things. The possibilities are enormous. But we do see through a glass darkly, no question about it. And I think our job, therefore, is to try not so much to predict the future, but to enable it to unfold, to create the policies that will provide a clear, attractive environment for us to explore this thing. Try it out. See what you can do with this kind of information system, and then make some investments, especially in the public sector, in which we assist libraries and educators and healthcare deliverers and government servants, state and federal, to use this to make their jobs work better for their clients, and then just see how it rolls.
Well, you know, referring a little earlier to what you were saying about, well, the consortiums, we know that we get out there and there's this, it starts to work, and then there's this natural falling away when we get into competitive areas. You know, as a scientist, it really isn't very scary to get into things that already don't have a procedural list. It's like, it's not any fun unless we really kind of don't know. Later on, we'll write up how it works. Let's go out there. But the source of my question may have a lot to do with the speed at which technology unfolds. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to say, well, we're sitting here, we don't have a road from the Atlantic to the Pacific, so we can fix the Atlantic and fix the Pacific. If we're here and we want to go to the moon, that's a fixed place, and we can go there.
And but that's a very easily defined target.
Very easily defined target. And so now we have a moving target, and the subtext on that is, and that's not only okay, that's a good idea. So if you go to a library, and a library only moves X amount of data from this place to that place, you say, let's try to do that 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. And that might take a month, and it might take 20 years. And if it takes a month, you say, okay, let's do it 1,000 times again. Now let's do it 100 times that. So that to fix the target on any of these areas, which are all at different levels and at different speeds and at different usages, that in effect might lead us off course as to where we're going to go.
Yeah, I think it would be a grave mistake to equate the information infrastructure to going to the moon because, as you say, first of all, the technology itself is rapidly changing. Secondly, we know that it is a ubiquitous change. It's going to influence our lives, our private, our corporate lives, our public lives, in many ways yet unforeseen. And to try, therefore, to make highly defined fixed targets is really not a good idea. It may even freeze technology. But we do know certain things. We want to make it interoperable. Mm-hmm. We want to have it competitive. Therefore, we have to set standards and then let the marketplace run in terms of who does what, where, and when. And I think it's fascinating to think of if we move now from the old confines of the copper cable and the coax to a fiber or to equivalent of fiber, very, very wideband information channels, how much of that, since it is, as it were, made available through a public licensing process, how much should we reserve for public use? If you have the equivalent of X hundred HDTV bands that you can connect to at least to a neighborhood, if not to a house, how much of that should simply be set aside for the public's good versus the delivery of, say, entertainment and television channels? So I think it'll be interesting to see what we do with that spare bandwidth for a while. But I agree with you. I think we should simply, we are an exploring nation. Let's explore with this. Under the common assumption that putting it in place is a partnership activity of public and private parties. And then let's let the winners come in and define themselves as we go along. I'm convinced there are a lot of winners. If you look, for instance, at internet right now, that thing has been growing at what, 15% per month?
Per month.
For years? Well, that's an unsustainable environment, but it tells you the extraordinary real-world opportunities that are now opening up, and that's just but a taste of what lies ahead for us. But it all goes back, you know, to having the capability to use information, and that goes back to our schools.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I have an affiliation with the university, and quite often for doing research for this and for other things that I do, I'm able to whistle right into that university, and I can ask, who's written what about what? Mm-hmm. And it would also be nice to say, and who's said it on television or on radio, which we don't have today. But I sit there at that screen, and I have all kinds of databases I can access. And I look across, and on the table there, they have years of those books about how you had to look up the periodic index.
Oh,
and
yes.
they're still sitting there. I love it. It's like, don't move them. But it is amazing to me. I'm able to bring up things from all over the world and say, oh, that happened 2 years ago, and boom. And when I have two boys, and my hope is for them, when they need knowledge, it's not to live in obscurity, to be able to walk in and ask those questions. And here we are in an age where, given all no one lives in a city or a town today where you couldn't look around and see public libraries closing, hours
That's
being
right.
limited,
yeah.
And it's time to turn that around and not only open them up again, but open them up so that they provide information at a much different level.
That's right. I agree. And I think it's time for us to really explore that as a people, and I believe we're going to win if we do it. And I can't define exactly how or when, But I just know that as this comes into play, it's going to continue to transform our society, and I think in a very productive way.
Moira is speaking with Dr. John Gibbons, science advisor to President Clinton. You're listening to TechNation, Americans in Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn. If you have any thoughts or comments about this or any other TechNation program, please send them to TechNation, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. That's TechNation, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. Dr. Gibbons served Congress as the director of the Office of Technology Assessment, where he established a strong record on energy and the environment. In this capacity, he's had a unique vantage point in observing the relation between politics and science.
Dr. Gibbons, you are also, among your many hats, you are executive director of the National Space Council. The space station project has been plagued with escalating costs and believability problems and all kinds of problems. And in February, the president said basically, you've got 90 days. Cut the costs in half or down and come up with three options for a space station, which contains both the building costs and the operating costs. Now, I understand that this coming week, NASA will be presenting their three options to the president. On what basis will you be judging these designs?
Well, you know, the space station is an opportunity as well as a problem that's been plaguing us and challenging us for a number of years. Our appetite has been high, and the costs have been accordingly high. And in fact, the costs have been accelerating over time, and every time you look at it, it becomes a moving target with the costs going only one way, namely up, and the functions or benefits of the station have been challenged many times by many people. It's seen not so much as a scientific frontier, but a technology frontier to try out things that push us in terms of technology development. We've also internationalized the project so that the Japanese, the Canadians, the Europeans are very deeply into this with us. So we can't make unilateral decisions. What we did find in January when we came in was that the station was not only a lot more expensive than it had been advertised, but even at that point, NASA was getting more and more surprises of costs escalating beyond original projections. And we knew that the Congress, already unhappy with this, and the new administration quite concerned about cost cutting, we have to cut the mustard somehow. Now, one thing we could have done was just to say we got to kill the station. But if you try to kill the station, first of all, you're killing a major activity of a lot of people in areas that are already impacted by defense conversion of the aerospace companies. Secondly, you try to kill the space station and the foreign partners that are already making major investments themselves in it are left out in the cold. Mm-hmm. And this prejudices the future opportunities for international ventures in space and technology. That's not good news either. So the real challenge was then for the new administration to start getting honest with the costs, which we hadn't been before, and to see what we could do about cutting it down to size, something that might be affordable for our new and more austere times. And that was the great challenge to NASA. And Dan Golden and others, I think, very courageously undertook a very rapid study of what options we might have for achieving most of the goals that we had, holding on to our international partners, and cutting the costs, we hope, by like a factor of two. That study is just now being completed. It's been a heroic day and night kind of venture. They found out some very interesting things, I can tell you. And on top of that internal NASA team that was put together, we created, appointed by the vice president, we created an advisory panel consisting of outside experts, people who have a lot of experience in the technology and the financing and the science and all the rest, to keep an eye on this, to have an oversight of the NASA study, and then to report to the president. And that's also going to happen this week. I think this coming week. Anyhow, between the 1st of June and the 20th of June, things have to come into place because the Congress needs numbers in order to do the 1994 appropriations process. Mm-hmm. So it's the congressional appropriations process that's now driving this thing to a very, very quick completion. Well, I think it was Samuel Johnson said there was nothing that focuses the mind like the night before the hanging. And that is, we're not looking at a hanging here, but we are focusing the mind because we had a deadline we have to meet. And in doing
so, met the hard place. Right.
So they had really a time of it, and we asked them to provide not a recommendation to the president. That's typically what NASA's done in the past. They come up and say, here's the plan, please approve it. Uh-huh. But we said, give us some options that are different over primarily in different costs. That is, you know, like Sears and Roebuck's good, better, best. Well, what we wanted was a way to look at the station in terms of a parametric representation of what you can do for how much money. Mm-hmm. And that's why these so-called of three major pieces.
It reflects three levels of funding.
Three levels of funding, and in each of those, what if you go to that kind of funding, what can you do for it, and how can you help yourself if you allow a little bit more time to go on in carrying out the project? What happens if you go to higher orbit so that you begin to go farther up on latitude and be able to intercept the European and the Japanese and the Russian orbit capabilities? So the president's going to have a pretty complicated package to look at, but it's going to give him some feeling for what you can get for how much money. And that'll be presented then to the Congress within the matter of a couple of weeks. And I think, I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but at least we're going to be operating with much more accurate, firm, honest numbers than we had in times past. And that, after all, is where we have to begin. And then we'll weigh that off against the kind of opportunities it provides.
Now, it sounds so good to be, you know, it's like, great, let's take a look at the designs, let's take a look at the function, let's take a look at how much money, how far should we go.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get down to some political realities. I understand that Congressman Brown, who is chair of the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, has said, after spending $8 million on the design of this space station, Freedom, he would not support any option that was not based on Freedom. And given that political reality, does this affect how you view the options?
Well, I think Chairman Brown, who is a splendid member of Congress, a very effective person, is entitled to his own views about what we should or should not be doing. I think he's going to want to look very carefully at these options, because in at least two of the three options, you can see a lot of space station Freedom there. It's in a different, it uses many of the same components that have been developed with that $8 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would claim that at least two-thirds of the options are derivatives from Space Station Freedom. But that doesn't mean that they're going to cost this enormous sum that Freedom was moving toward. And I think if we all take a look at these options when they come out, I think, and look at them seriously, look at the numbers, we can all come to, a conclusion based on the facts rather than on the fancies, which I think in times past have been too much governing the way we look at things. You know, we're in a post-Cold War time now. Station used to be sold on the basis that we got to have one because the Russians have one, right? And now we're trying basically to say, well, we ought to have an international station and all of us work together. So the whole game has changed enormously, mm-hmm, here in the past half dozen years. And I think that means we should understand that what we do now is in a totally different world from where we started when we began this process. And to say we should continue what we were doing simply because that's what we were doing does not take full advantage of the real fact that the world has changed extraordinarily in just a few years' time.
For 13 years, you were director of the Office of Technology Assessment. Tell us about the role of that office.
Yeah, that was a fun job, I must say. I thought when I came to Washington to direct that office, which is a nonpartisan expert analysis group for the Congress, for both the Democrats and the Republicans, the House and the Senate, I thought, well, it would be a fun job for 3 or 4 years, and I stayed 13. And I think that reflects the fact that sort of a common asset, a shared resource for the whole of the Congress, a small group of people, very diverse in their technical backgrounds, half scientists and engineers and doctors, and the other half are social scientists and lawyers and economists and the likes, working in various teams on big socio-technical problems.
And I understand it only had an annual budget of $6 million, which gets repeated a lot. It's like, it was the best deal in the government.
It was six back in 1979.
Oh.
And it has in terms of purchasing power, it has just a little bit more than that now, although inflation has carried it up to about $20 million.
Uh-huh.
But it is, I think, a good investment because it was used by 40-odd different committees. So you divide that amongst all those committees, and they all were using that common resource. And in fact, many of the studies OTA carried out were done simultaneously at the request of, say, a half a dozen different committees. So I think it's a good example of how you can pool your resources in the legislative branch and draw the system together that is inherently fractured otherwise by the different committees.
Sure.
A little bit like OSTP in the executive branch, where you have a small group that helps pull together all of these different executive agencies. But OTA was fun in that we had opportunity to do some pretty careful studies of things and to engage in a very substantive way the stakeholders from outside government, so that when we got finished, we were able to tell the members what the facts were, what you could really, everyone pretty well agree on, and we therefore helped focus the arguments down to those things that you could not agree on from the facts, and Congress would have to wrestle with in terms of the political process. But that helped focus the debate, and the members found that very helpful.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. John Gibbons, Assistant to the President for Science and Technology and Director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. You are known for your energy and environmental policies and for your strong stance, which is very interesting in the government area. For example, in February of 1991, and I'll quote Edmund Andrews of the New York Times here, OTA issued a toughly worded report arguing the Department of Energy had, quote, neither the capability nor the credibility to meet its goal of cleaning up the radioactive waste from nuclear plants in 30 years. What is the radioactive waste situation in the United States, and what should be our policy on the use and disposal of radioactive materials?
We inherited a lot of the rad waste, the toughest part of the rad waste business, from World War II.
Mm.
During the time of the Manhattan Project, we were worried about surviving the war, and we're not so much worried about some of the waste that was being produced when we were developing those weapons or the capability to make those weapons. And it was felt that, you know, by and by, down the road, we'll take care of those things. We'll turn them into concrete or glass and bury them. And it was a big bill. And as time went on, they kept deferring that bill, saying, well, there are other things we can do that are more important right now. But we can fix it. And now it has gotten to the point where technically, yes, you can fix it. You can immobilize the stuff and get it into geological areas where you can be quite well assured that if that's a problem, it's not going to be a problem like some of the rest of our problems we're facing. But what the fact is that as a nation, we have first of all been unwilling to commit the kinds of resources it's going to take to clean up that situation. And secondly, we've gotten more and more of not in my backyard attitudes, in which no state or set of states is willing to take on the load for the rest of the nation without some kind of compensation. So we're still in a mess, and most of the mess is 50 years old now. Is World War II mess. And as you look around, we've had a lot of these mistakes of the past that now come to visit us. I remember Charlie Schulz's cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called?
Peanuts.
In which
this is high technology here.
Lucy is exclaiming to Linus. She says, "You know, all the world's problems are being shoved at us. This generation," says Lucy, "has really been given the works. We've had it. What do you?" And so Charlie, the great straight man, says, "Well, what do you think we ought to do about it?" And Lucy thinks for a minute, and she said, "Well, we'll stick the next generation." And I think that's what we've done with a lot of these problems. We put them off, and we'll leave it for the next generation. That's what got us into this enormous debt problem we're in now. We're just borrowing from the kids. And that works for a while, but now the interest on that debt is the second biggest item on the federal budget behind health care. So I think rad waste and all these other things relate to the fact that it's all too easy to put off something and leave it for the next folks, and that's not a good idea. Mm. The fact is, I think you can do it. In fact, one of the authors of that OTA study has just been taken on as a senior official in the Department of Energy in the waste management area, so I think that report's still going to find
helpful.
Its use.
That's very true. We've already talked a little about Congress, you know, getting into the act and what finally happened. Certainly no funds will be released on anything until Congress approves. And in the area of just strictly scientific research, Senator Bennett Johnson, chair of the Energy Committee, has proposed legislation to restrict nuclear fusion research to the tokamak research, which is the MELT methodology alone, as I understand it. And the scientific community agrees that actual results from tokamak can't be expected for some 20, 30 years. It uses radioactive fuel, it produces radioactive waste, and it utilizes almost the entirety of the $360 million annual budget for fusion research. And his legislation passed his committee this week. Now, just last week I was speaking with Dr. Glenn Seaborg, who sends mm-hmm. his best regards to you.
Thank you. He's a wonderful person.
He said, "Boy, Jack, he's a great guy, and he's got a big job." So please send him my best regards. And for our listeners, Dr. Seaborg was head of the Atomic Energy Commission under three presidents and is a Nobel laureate. He was discussing with me some alternative nuclear fusion research at MIT, University of Wisconsin, and University of California, Irvine, I believe, which is not radioactive in nature, but is nuclear fusion research. It uses collider technology, and there's been some successes, apparently most of it privately funded. And Dr. Seaborg found this to be very promising research. And so here you are. And when I spoke to him, it was before I was aware of Senator Johnson's legislation and it passing his committee. And I'm thinking, here you are, the science advisor of the president. You're promoting of so many things, including, you know, radioactive waste mm-hmm. and management and this type of thing. And as a scientist, you've got to examine all reasonable alternatives. I mean, that's your urge, mm-hmm. obviously, to do that. And yet you have Congress seeking to limit scientific research alternatives for whatever reason, and I can't speak to that. I have a lot of sympathy for your position. How can you, as a science advisor to the president, go about supporting funding of an alternative research like a non-radioactive nuclear fusion in a climate like that?
I'm not sure you can have fusion without some radioactivity, quite honestly. Mm. I'm not quite sure what Dr. Seaborg was talking about, but there are various ways to try to fuse light nuclei together and get the energy out of them. All of those, essentially, those that are promising in terms of the reaction rates, you end up with some radioactivity because you uh-huh. make free neutrons and they in turn do things.
Uh-huh.
And you also have tritium involved, which is a radioactive
sure.
form of hydrogen. But that kind of radioactivity is far, far, far less than the radioactivity you get from fission
mm-hmm.
and the fission products and the transuranic or the so-called actinides that come mm-hmm. from the fission side of things.
Uh-huh.
So whether it be fusion or fission, you got radioactivity, but a very different of sort if you can make fusion work. Now, the issue is how can you make fusion work? One is to hold it into a magnetic bottle, and that's the tokamak.
Uh-huh.
That is the major international thing called ITER, the International mm-hmm. Thermonuclear Energy Research Project. And there are some other ways people have thought about banging this stuff together with lasers and the likes. I think what Senator Johnson was after was for the nation to put together a much more thoughtful, strategic paper on how do we go about the fusion business. It's getting into big business now. The new machines are enormously expensive. If you want to build a new experimental device, it's not $1,000, it's $1 billion. And so it's big science inherently. If it's big science, and if it's generic, just like the other partnerships we're talking about, it ought to be international. It ought to not be just public-private, it ought to be an international venture. And that's where the ITER is, and I think Senator Johnson is supportive of that idea. The other question is, how much should we be putting into fusion versus other things in energy, whether it be conservation or advanced fission, or how to make a more efficient use of natural gas and the likes. Those are all really tough questions. I think what Senator Johnson is doing, honestly, is trying to force the point of saying it's getting to be big dollars now. We need to be much more thoughtful, strategic, and international in our thinking about where we're going to go from here with this idea of fusion.
So what he's saying, in your view, is not that he's trying to restrict alternatives. He's saying, let's get focused in this one area.
I believe that's what he's saying. And there are always going to be some other ideas around. Science always has a few other notions, and those may surface. But when you're in a time of tough budgets and having to really trim very carefully what you're doing and postpone some things, some of those experiments, just like some of the experiments in advanced fission that burns up these actinides, for instance, we're simply having to defer because everyone has to share in our getting this daggone deficit down. If we don't get deficit down, we're borrowing money that otherwise could go to productive things, and we're not going to make our way out of the hole that we dug over the last 15 years. So everyone's going to have to take the hit, including my office. That's why I have the Space Council and OSD, all these other things, the collapsing of once different offices in the White House into a more streamlined operation. In other words, take on more work, but you don't get more people. That's the way it goes. But to reiterate, we have to cut wherever we can, and science is not going to be exempt from the same kind of cutting that has to go elsewhere across our federal budget.
So in the sense that Congress, through legislation and through withholding legislation or approvals that could come forward, you go forward in the best way that you know how.
We have to pick our shots a lot more carefully, and there's some things we have to leave on the table that are very good, very promising, and if we had the money, we'd certainly want to do it, but we don't have that much money, and we're going to have to defer some things.
I see. If you could accomplish one thing in your tenure as the science advisor, head of OSTP, and the 15 other hats you have on, what would that be?
Well, that's an interesting one. First,
you can do more than one.
You better let me do more than one, because I haven't done
science. I'm going to limit you to one here.
They've had me going so fast since I got here, I've hardly had a time to think strategically about my own job, I have to confess to you. But I think there are two or three things I'd like to leave behind, and I hope before Christmas comes, before the first of the four-year adventure we're on is over, I will be able to be much more articulate about this. But let me tick off two or three to you. One is, I want to help continue to reflect the president's notion that science and technology are indeed the engines of growth, of progress, and that if we pick and choose carefully and continue to support basic science, we're going to provide the new options we need to have a strong economy in the future, to create jobs, and to begin to pay back some of the debt.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one, support of science and technology for those public reasons. A second would be to try to establish a rhythm of cooperation between the public and private sector on such things as the Clean Car Initiative, which we're working on now to try to get it set, education initiatives, the energy, the technology extension services, all of these things, the new kind of partnership between public and private sector to get things, to make things happen. Mm-hmm. So that's a second big area to work on. If we can do those two things alone, and if we can resolve our extraordinarily challenging healthcare situation, which is in turn driven not only by demographic change, but also by technology, those three things would be would put us a long way up in the right direction. I could give you another dozen, but I think that's a good start.
I think that is a good start. Finally, we've been so fortunate to have you invite us out to your farm here.
And it I'm delighted to have you out here.
Thank you. It is absolutely, to me, here we are talking to the sort of the head scientist of the United States, the chief technologist, and here we are on this working farm. This is a farm. And just the juxtaposition, it's like, this is really great. Tell us some things about how you use technology in your farm.
Oh, that's an interesting point. The farm is a wonderful release for me because I can manage 70 hours a week or so, but I have to have a time to recharge some of my own batteries, and this is one way to do it. One thing is, for instance, the house that we're in now is designed to be very, very energy efficient by the placement of the double roof, by the double glazed windows around, and by the 2x6 studs around the wall, and the insulation we've put in, and the high efficiency heat pumps and the likes, so that the house itself to me is reflective of that same Oriental tradition of understatement. You know, if you look at Oriental art, frequently it's a beautiful understatement of something. For instance, you'll find a snuff bottle that's made of the hardest possible stone, jade, mm-hmm. and delicately carved. And you wonder, how in the world did they carve that jade? It's an understatement. If you take a little netsuke, a little ivory carving, a beautiful, say, little animal, you find that even when you turn it upside down and look at the feet, it's all there. It's perfectly carved. Well, it seems to me what we try to do with a house is the same thing. To have it perform in ways that aren't visible to you, but turn out to be very, very, in this case, resource and energy efficient. Uh-huh. There are not a lot of other technologies we've used here. I have tried to bury all the lines, all of the utility lines, so that they're very low maintenance. And I've tried to fix up a hydraulic system so that I control the way the water moves on the place for maximum water conservation. And again, all of these are not visible, but they're there, and it took a lot of hard work, and I'm pleased to have it that way. But the best technology for me on the weekend is a manure fork when we clean the stalls for the horses. You know, getting into the stalls and cleaning them out not only provides you with great manure to put on the garden and great physical exercise, but it's a nice sort of complementary practice to working in Washington, where we have to handle a lot of that stuff in other ways during the week.
A man with a perspective on life and his job.
Moira's guest has been Dr. John Gibbons, science advisor to President Clinton and director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Paul Claudel, Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Special thanks for additional support from National Public Radio. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.